our childhood, brainwashed by the school, brainwashed by our teachers, and brainwashed by all the rules, brainwashed by our leaders, by our kings and queens, brainwashed in the open and brainwashed behind the scenes.
Highly confused.
He's a normaton.
Let's challenge his shattered view of the world.
Here's a little wedge for the never believer. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Would you rather know all the things we know?
We have one stand up for true.
Or would you turn away to? All of the things that's wrong, would you stand tall and strong, or would you turn and walk away? What would you do if you knew all the things we knew?
Love is the only truth, everything else is illusion.
I'll pick up your hand and slowly blow your little mind, because I've made my mind up.
One thing I can tell you is you got to be free. Come together right now.
Oh,
hello, this is Ron Paul with your weekly update for March 9th. Congress is poised to pass the President's emergency plan for AIDS relief, unconstitutional foreign aid. The bill passed out of the Foreign Affairs Committee with a bipartisan agreement to nearly double the President's requested amount. It is always distressing to see officials in our government reach across the aisle to disregard constitutional limitations. Much of this aid will run through government-to-government channels and will be vulnerable to corruption. Some of the aid will be sent to faith-based organizations who, along with accepting government largesse, will now be subject to government controls and will soon become more dependent on taxpayer funding than private funds. If they accept the aid, they must be careful of the vague language regarding what types of programs they can run. For example, the requirement that 33% of any funding received must go toward abstinence-only programs has been dropped and replaced with a 50% requirement toward behavior change. Many humanitarian organizations are incensed by the politicized requirements placed on their work and feel they are being forced to continue failed programs at the expense of more effective ones. The obvious question remains, why are politicians in the United States deciding what is best for people in Africa? And why are taxpayers in the United States being forced to fund, for example, family planning facilities that perform abortions? In fact, Afrobarometer, a leading source of data on public attitudes in Africa, asked Africans what their main developmental concerns were. They found that Africans are much more concerned about jobs, agriculture, and basic infrastructure than they are about health issues like AIDS. Africans should decide what is best for Africa. American taxpayers should decide what charities deserve their money. Forcibly taking money from the American people and sending it overseas is unconstitutional and immoral. The energy that lobbying groups and celebrities expend for charitable causes here in the Hill could be better spent to use it actually addressing the problems. It is sadly symptomatic of the trend toward bigger government that instead of private fundraising efforts, people put their hand out to Congress. It is unfortunate that some activists prefer funding taken by force to donations freely given. These efforts, though well-meaning, are misguided. The truth is, all the foreign aid in the world will not transform Africa into a thriving, healthy continent. The economic growth of Africa depends on African entrepreneurs, liberalized trade policies, and political and economic freedom. The best thing we could possibly do for Africa and for our own country is to stop sending misguided aid and to stop protectionist trade practices that prevent African farmers and producers from competing in our markets. Perhaps then Africa's leaders would focus less on how to get aid out of the United States and more on the economic vitality of their own countries. Thanks for calling this update. A new update is placed on at this number, 888-322-1414, every Monday morning. The written text of which can be found on my...
All right. No problem. Thanks, Ron Paul. I hope y'all got all that. And I did want to see if we could get this. Welcome to Total Information Radio. We have some audio for you tonight. Here is Bush singing The Other Night.
And then I wake and look around me at the old walls that surround me, and I realize I was only dreaming. Well, there's Condi and Dick, my old compadre, talking to me about some oil-rich Saudi. But soon I'll touch the brown, brown grass of home. Yes, you're all gonna miss me the way you used to quiz me.
But soon I'll touch the brown.
Backup singers are Gunnery Sergeant Kevin Veneer. And singing out of Jacksonville, Texas, Staff Sergeant Sarah DeLong.
Yeah!
My man on the ivories, Gridiron's own John Fluck.
Yeah!
Retired Lieutenant Commander. And my musical director, the very well known Colonel Mike Colton. The president making his farewell appearance at the Gridiron will usually say the most glowing and gushing and flowering things about the press. But knowing me the way that you do,
I was worried you wouldn't believe it. So let me give you a simple truth that I believe wholeheartedly. You can't have them all.
And who else? We had John McManus.
Hi. We remember the old John Birch Society. The founding of John Birch Society and all these different descriptions of what he was doing, how it was sometimes a sinister description of what he's up to politically. And actually, in the later years, he's not one of these guys that got hired as a CEO later on. He's been with the doctor. He's taken a lot of income from this organization over a long period of time. He's also the author, but he's also publishes their magazine, which is The New American, and contributes, of course, to that in the monthly book. And he's the author of Financial Terrorism, 1993, Changing Command, The Betrayal of America's Military, 1995, and what he's going to spend a little time with today because of the Fed, which is in trouble. He also is three of that plus three junior Pied Piper for the establishment in 2002. So, with that further news, it's supposed to be terrible. After that, I just made a speech that I'm giving
You're listening to Revere Radio Network. John McManus, president of the John Birch Society, speaking in Washington, D.C., Wednesday, March 12th. Go to revereradio.info and donate some money to listener-supported radio, and go to total411.info to figure out even more about the world conspiracy.
Thank you very much, John, and ladies and gentlemen. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. I will speak for a time about Mr. Buckley, but I'm going to spend more time on a history lesson. There are people today who wonder why the United States does not seal the border with Mexico and why we do not take care of obeying a portion of the Constitution that says that it's a requirement of the federal government to protect the country from an invasion. And an invasion is certainly what we have. We've got 20 million or even more than 20 million illegal immigrants in this country, and unfortunately that's what we do have. But I will start off with William Buckley, and I'll tell you that in 1962, I was a devotee of William Buckley. I was a follower of his magazine, and I kept waiting for him to say something about the John Birch Society that had been in the headlines for quite a while. And a lot of nasty things were being said about the Birch Society, that we were a secret organization, that we were fascists, that we were like the Klan, that we were like the Nazis, that you name it, that we were anti-Semites, and so on and so on. And I kept waiting for William Buckley's magazine to come out and say something about this John Birch Society. So early in 62 he did, and he came out with a six-page editorial that started off by saying that there's a lot of good people in the John Birch Society, but what they ought to do is get rid of that screwball Robert House, who was the founder and the leader of the John Birch Society. Well, I didn't know any better, and I read that thing twice. It was important to me at the time. And I sent him a letter and thanked him for the editorial, and lo and behold, they published it in the newspaper, in the magazine. But because they did, somebody who was a local member of the John Birch Society saw that my name was at the bottom of the letter in my hometown, and he looked it up in the phone book. And he wrote me a letter, and he said, are you basing your attitude about Robert Welch based on what Robert Welch has said or what others have said of him? And I said, well, that was a very good question. So I wrote back to the man, and I said, you share with me what you think I ought to know. And he sent me some material. I intended to show him how wrong he was, but it turned out to be the other way around. I began to read the books that the Birch Society had published, and a lot of them were books that had been taken out of circulation, couldn't find them anywhere, and I began to be more concerned, and I eventually joined the Birch Society, and then they asked me to join the staff. I became a member of the staff in 1966, so I've been at it a long time. They named me the president in 1991. said, I always started to watch William Buckley, and I said to myself, there's something wrong here. So in the year 2002, I finally put together a lot of my own research, and I wrote a book called William F. Buckley, Jr., Fight Piper for the Establishment. That's the opposite opinion that most people would have had of this man, that he was anti-establishment, that he was somebody who would be opposed to what we call the ruling establishment, the elite, and so on. Well, anyhow, the book came out. It became quite a cause celeb in 2002, 2003, and 2004. And it's kind of faded out a little bit now, but since he has just passed away, there are people who are interested in it. So what did I find out about William Buckley? Well, William Buckley finished Yale in 1950, and then he wrote that book called God and Man at Yale, which was supposedly a very severe attack on the university for its socialism and its anti-Christian activity. But what I found after reading the book was that he really didn't. He did point out some things at Yale that were going on, but he didn't condemn the organization. He said, instead, that as long as the alumni of the university want this or allowed this, that it was perfectly okay with them. That's kind of a modern attitude. And if you've seen any of the obituaries of William Buckley, you see that he is the founder of modern conservatism. Well, modern conservatism is not the conservatism even of his own father. He was very, very much the son of the elder William Buckley, that he parted company with that man, who died when William Buckley was still fairly young. The old right conservatives were not modern conservatives. They were tough, old right conservatives. They strongly believed in a non-interventionist foreign policy and constitutional principles and limited government and so on. They were very, very tough about the whole thing. They included author John T. Flynn and economist Murray Rothbard, Ohio Senator Robert Tabb, the Chicago Tribune's Robert McCormick, and the John Birch Society's founder, Robert Bush, and along with Buckley's own father. Now, it has also been said of William Buckley many, many times that House Republican leader John Boehner of Ohio, for instance, labeled him the architect of the modern conservative movement. The New York Times said his greatest achievement was making conservatism respectable. Well, respectable to whom? Respectable to the Times. Respectable to the liberals, who he was supposed to be the enemy of. So he redefined the term conservative. And I began to see this, and I began to stuff things in a file, never knowing when I would ever do anything with it. Finally, some of my colleagues persuaded me, it's time for you to take him on and write a book about him, because of all the nasty things he said about the John Birch Society. So he did. And the book is out. Now, what do we know about William Buckley? We know that he graduated Yale in 1950. He wrote God and Man in Yale, and he supposedly excoriated the university, but he was pulling his punch on that one, because he sent his own son, the only child he ever had, Christopher, he sent him to Yale. And that you wouldn't have guessed if you read the headlines about what William Buckley was supposed to have said. Now, while he was in Yale, he formed a very close relationship with his favorite professor, a man named Wilmore Kendall. Wilmore Kendall was a Trotskyite, a Trotskyite being a socialist who wanted to take control of the world through persuasion rather than through the hammer and the weapons. Wilmore Kendall was also a graduate of the OSS in World War II, the Office of Strategic Services, the leader of which was a man named William Donovan, who said that he filled it with communists, and he had. And then the OSS became the CIA. So we had Wilmore Kendall, who came from the Trotskyite movement to the OSS to the CIA, and then a professor at Yale, and he and Buckley became very close, very intimate. When Buckley graduated in 1950, the Korean War had just broken out. He had served for a short time at the end of World War II, and he was afraid of being called back into the military. So he listened to Wilmore Kendall, and he said, well, why don't you go to work for the CIA? which he did. He went to the CIA, he was trained in Washington, and then he went on to Mexico. And while he was in Mexico in 1952, he wrote an article for a Catholic magazine called Commonweal. And in its January 1952 issue, Buckley said that the way to counter the communist threat, this is a quote from William Buckley on 1952, we have got to accept big government for the duration through the instrument of a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores. He stressed the need to support, quote, the attendant centralization of power in Washington, even with Truman at the reins of all of it. Now, that is absolutely not what the image of William Buckley is. But that was 1952. When he went to go to the CIA, Wilmore Kendall introduced him to another man who became his very close friend, a man named James Burnham. James Burnham, like Wilmore Kendall, was a former Trotskyite, a member of the CIA, a member of the OSS before that. And so finally they got around to starting a magazine in 1955. I should mention also that during the middle 50s, Buckley formed a very close relationship with a man named Henry Kissinger, who at that point was a professor at Harvard University, and he led the university's CIA-funded international seminar. So here we see CIA Kendall, CIA Burnham, CIA Kissinger, CIA Buckley, and when they started the magazine, they had another man named Frank Meyer come aboard, and Frank Meyer had been a communist in both Britain and the United States. And the other key person at the start of the National Review magazine was Priscilla Buckley, Buckley's sister, who had also worked for the CIA. So the history here is unsettling to people who don't know it, but it's a good thing to know about this man. Now, what did Buckley accomplish? Well, he accomplished becoming the what you might call the gatekeeper of the conservative movement. If you did not toe the line that he was promoting, and it became fairly obvious that he was promoting socialism as early as 1960 when he had a favorable article about John Maynard Keynes, the famous British socialist, in his magazine. He began to stigmatize anybody that didn't go along with him, and that, of course, meant the John Birch Society. He was later expelled from the ranks of the respectable conservative movement. People like Pat Buchanan and Joe Sobran and other old writers walked away from him, and these included Bedford Evans and his son, M. Stanton Evans, and Frank Rozelle, his former roommate at Yale, Kevin Phillips, Thomas Lane, Ralph DiCapitano, and a whole bunch of others just walked away from Buckley and said, I've had it, I'm not going to have any more to do with this. It is not upholding the views that we have. And in time, Buckley would support the giveaway of the Panama Canal. He would promote foreign aid. He would suggest the need for compulsory national service. He would excuse the subversion of the United Nations. He advocated wage and price controls. He agonized that Henry Kissinger could not become president of the United States because he was not because he was foreign born. He waged war against any notion that a conspiracy explained America's leftward march. And he authored numerous salacious speeches. Pieces of literature for the Penthouse and the pornographic magazines. He defended the betrayal of the nationalist anti-communists in China and Taiwan. And then he proudly and openly joined the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the epitome of the establishment. So it should come as no surprise that he waged a decades-long war on the John Birch Society, even claiming that he would destroy our organization. But he didn't succeed. The John Birch Society continues to reach out to Americans all across the country, and we think it important to recognize that the respectable conservative, such as William Buckley, there will be others who want to follow in his footsteps, but being a respectable conservative, when your respect comes from the New York Times and from liberal media and so forth, it's not anything that I'm interested in, nor is the job. So that's enough about him. We have copies of the book here. I also have a DVD of the program. It's a half an hour long. It's called The Overview of America. It's about what America's roots are, what they should be, and how we should get back to it. And this, I want everybody to take a copy. This is no charge. I have to charge for the book. I have to charge you $20 if you want a copy of the book. So we have that problem. Well, now I'm going to get into another program here, and I could call this program The Reason Why the Buildings Haven't Been Closed, and we're going to do a bit of a history lesson here. I see a hand up. John Burke, John Burke, what did I? It's a good question, and I probably should have touched on it. Well, everything I said that he was for, we're opposed to. John Burke was a young Christian missionary from the state of Georgia. He went to China in 1940 to preach the Baptist faith. While he was there, World War II broke out. He volunteered for service with the American forces under the famous General Pershing and all of the Flying Tigers. He served with distinction throughout the war as an intelligence operator. He spoke the Chinese language. He was short stature. He looked almost Chinese. He could live and move amongst them. He became a legend in his own time. He built airfields behind the Japanese lines. He did everything you would imagine of an intelligence operator and more. Highly decorated. And 10 days after the war ended in August of 1945, he was killed by Chinese communists. He was sent on a mission to find out if these people were friend or foe, and he found out with his life that they were foe. But our government was telling everybody that the Chinese communists were agrarian reformers, that they weren't really communists. It took John Birch's parents over 5 years to find out what had really happened to their son. They knew that he had died, they knew he was deceased, but they didn't know why. Well, when China fell in 1949, then the John Birch family was allowed to find out the reason why he had been killed. But his parents were not happy about that. Robert Welsh, a man who was a manufacturer of candy products up in Massachusetts, the Welsh Candy Company, Fudge Bars and Sugar Daddy, Sugar Baby, that was the candy company. He was also a historian, and he heard a little bit about the story of John Birch, went and investigated it. Eventually in 1954, he wrote a book called The Life of John Birch. If you want to read a story of a real American hero, The Life of John Birch. I recommend it very highly. In 1958, Robert Welsh decided to form an organization to bring information to the American people, kind of wake the town and tell the people organization. And he asked the parents if he could use their son's name as a symbol. They said yes, happily. They became members of the John Birch Society, and I got to meet them both before they passed away. And they were wonderful people. So that's who John Birch was. We're very proud to carry his name. I'm glad you asked the question. So we're going to get into now, we'll get into a little bit of what we're for, and then, of course, a lot of what we're against. I brought my PowerPoint presentation here. We'll start with what are we for? We're for America. The Declaration of Independence. The philosophical base of our nation is right there. Those two little passages. Men are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. They didn't come from nowhere. The government didn't give us our rights. It came from God. And then, almost in the same sentence, they said, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. So what are we saying here? We're saying that there is a God, He gave us our rights, and we use the rights that we have to form a government for what purpose? To protect those rights and nothing more. Not to redistribute the wealth, not to take control of people's lives, not to dominate their existence, simply to protect their rights. Eventually, the British didn't like that, so we had a little war, we beat the British, we sent them back across the sea, and then in 1787, they got together and they found that the Articles of Confederation were deficient, so they said, all right, let's have a whole new system, and put together the Constitution of the United States. A Constitution that limits the government, not the people. How important a notion is that? It protects rights, it doesn't grant them. I run into people all the time who talk about their Second Amendment rights. No, that's the wrong way of putting it. the way to properly put it is that they have rights protected by the Second Amendment, protected by the Fourth Amendment, so on. God-given rights. The Constitution was chosen by the states. It was not forced upon the people. It went back for ratification. And the states remain sovereign in most areas. We used to, in this country, more than 100 years ago, always referred to these United States, not the United States. And that's a very good distinction. So that's what we're for in the John Birch Society. I mentioned this already. The U.S. Constitution, Article 4, Section 4, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a Republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion. Each of them against invasion. As I mentioned, 20 million invaders. I don't know what else you could call it except an invasion. His demonstrations that were held in early in 2006. Upside down American flag, Mexican flag flying in front of it, people desecrating the flag. We march today, tomorrow we vote, no human being is illegal, and so on and so on. So this really stirred a lot of Americans. You may remember this. It's about 2 years ago this time. And it was on the television, and a lot of people got upset. So President Bush came out in a speech May 15th of 2006, and he said he was going to fix the illegal immigration problems. He said he was going to control the border. He was going to put technological border security. Maybe you saw recently that the so-called virtual fence isn't working, and they put it off now for another 3 years. They're going to add a National Guard. They did send some National Guard that troops down there, but not to the border. These were people behind the scenes, not at the border. Most of them have been called back now. They're not there anymore. He's going to confront the drug traffic and the crime. You talk to a policeman in Arizona or a policeman in California and ask him about the controlling of the drug traffic and the crime, and it's not being done. And, of course, he was going to oppose amnesty. Well, the Senate came up with an amnesty proposal. They didn't call it that. They called it the guest worker program. And that was McCain and Kennedy. McCain, of course, every piece of legislation that he's been involved in, his cohort was a Democrat. That's another story. So Mr. Bush promised all that and delivered nothing. But what he did deliver was he recognized the Social Security Qualification Act, which gives Social Security benefits to Mexicans. He accepted the matricular consular ID card issued by the government of Mexico that enables people to get driver's license and so forth. He started additional border crossings with the guest worker program that really was an amnesty program. And then he placed our nation in the Security and Prosperity Partnership. Hey, can I have that? That's really interesting. That's better. I'm good. Here's the first one. Thank you. Yes. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we proceed. This is the way my ancestors came to America, and maybe a lot of yours as well. If you're Anglo-Saxon, your people came across, and they went through Ellis Island, most of them. This is what was going on back then. And these were people who were willing to come here with practically nothing and to take advantage of the system here in our country, which is freedom. And those people became laborers, a lot of them. Then their sons became somewhat entrepreneurs, and their grandsons became professional people on the upward mobility in our country, second to none, and due mostly because of the Constitution and the limitation of government. This is a scene that depicting the final end of the Roman Empire. Maybe some of you know about the Emperor Valens in the latter years of the Roman Empire. They were a lot of gods, the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths, outside the borders of the Roman Empire. Probably a lot of them in Hungary and places. And these people wanted to come in. Well, Valens decided that he needed more people in his army and he needed more people as laborers. So he let the Goths come in, and the Goths soon outnumbered the Romans. And they had a battle, a famous war, the Battle of Hadrianople, where Valens himself was killed, and the Goths went all the way to Rome and sacked the place, and that was the formal end of the Roman Empire. And it was because of immigration. At that point, it was legal immigration. Can this happen to our country? Well, if you go down to Southern California, you'll find all kinds of people down there who are saying we're going to take back California and Arizona and Nevada and portions of other states. We're going to take them back because they were stolen from Mexico in the first place, which is a lie, but that's what they intend to do. All right. Now, I'm going to get into discussing free trade here. We're going to focus a little bit on the NAFTA agreement, the North American Free Trade Agreement. There's NAFTA, which is free trade, and there's protectionism, which is trade that has tariffs. This is a book that's being used in college classrooms today. I know a man who teaches an MBA program, and he shared with me this book. He said, in free trade area, did this author, Charles W. L. Hill, in free trade area, all barriers to the trade of goods and services among member countries are removed. Well, what would some of those barriers be? Well, certainly borders would be one of them, and a lot of other things besides. And then when I talked about there are several levels of economic integration. The free trade area starts it off, and then there's a customs unit, the union. Then there's a common market, and of course you've heard that term referring to Europe. Then there's economic union, and that's what you see now. The European Union is a started out as the EEC, European Economic Union. And then a political union. And once you have a political union, you don't have a country anymore. And so this man was pointing out that this is what free trade leads to. He's absolutely correct. There's somebody else who was in favor of free trade. Well, I mean, Karl Marx. Free trade breaks up old nationalities. In a word, the free trade system hastens social revolution. Marx said that in Brussels, 1838. It's just prior to when he wrote the Communist Manifesto. Here's another book that was published in 1955. A man named Lewis Lloyd, and he wrote a book about tariffs. Case for protectionism. He said eight steps are needed for free trade, and then he went in and he discussed them all, and I'm just going to give you the headlines. The first step was a single monetary system. They now have that in Europe, with the euro. Are all countries the most. So taxes must be comparable. If you start thinking about this, if you're going to have free trade, you've got to have these kinds of things. Taxes must be comparable. Uniform business laws. Uniform similar business ethics. Uniform wage rates. Maximum labor mobility. Freedom from the threat of war, and of course, then he concluded it, you've got to have world government if you're going to have free trade on a world like this. Well, obviously, he was opposed to that, so was John Hersey's day. That all makes very good sense. Here's Robert Welch, the man who founded the John Hersey's day. In 1972, he made a statement. The plan is to establish the first stages of a new world order. This will be the Novus Ordo Seclorum, for which a self-perpetuating inner circle of conspirators had been working and scheming relentlessly during some six generations. Yes, very much of it. And you see the phrase Novus Ordo Seclorum there. You all know that, you've all seen it. It's on the back of the dollar bill. It literally means New Order of the Ages, and it has been frequently translated New World Order. We'll get to that. All right, now Robert Welch here, 72, he's talking about some six generations. Right? A generation is, let's say, three generations every 100 years. So he's talking six generations in 72, go back 200 years. You go back to 200 years, and what do you find? You find an organization called the Illuminati in Bavaria. It was formed on May 1st of 1776. Incidentally, communists and socialists celebrate May Day, May 1st, for that reason, and most of them don't even know it. What was Weishaupt in favor of? He wanted to obliterate Christianity, deification of sensuality. You can see some of this happening in our country today. Please don't think it's just happening by chance.
one destruction of property rights, renunciation of all religion, repudiation of marriage, state control of children, and world government. A lot of that has happened. Weishaupt was a brilliant organizer. He took control of continental European Freemasonry, and he did so at the Congress of Wilhelmstad in 1783. He and his people brought on the French Revolution, from which France has never recovered. In 1798, there were two books written about this conspiracy against the revolution. The one on the left, Proofs of a Conspiracy, by a British professor named John Robison. The one on the right, by a Catholic priest named the Abbe Augustin Barrowell. And these men didn't know each other. Barrowell is a Catholic priest who had fled France for his life, because the French Revolution had killed tens of thousands of priests. And it's havoc throughout the country, as you know if you know any history of the French Revolution. Neither of those men met, and the information they had about the Illuminati is exactly the same. They had sources were exactly the same. So there was no conflict between these two books. These two books, incidentally, we published, we make available if anybody is interested in looking at that sort of history. And so the Illuminati was exposed, and here we have George Washington, who left the presidency in 1797, and he read the book from England, Proofs of a Conspiracy, in 1798. And he thanked Herbert Snyder of Frederickstown, Maryland, who had sent him the book. I think that is just perfect today, perfect now. He stated in his letter of thanks, "Reverend Sir, it was not my intention to doubt that the doctrine of the Illuminati had not spread in the United States. On the contrary, no one is more satisfied with this fact than I am." And through the efforts of George Washington, John Adams, John Jay, and several others, the conspiracy of the Illuminati was put down in our country. It was exposed to a degree, but it was not fully exposed. Here's another book that was written in 1921, New England, at the Bavarian Illuminati. And the letter you see there is a handwritten letter from George Washington. And he wrote it to a preacher in Boston named Jedediah Morse, the father of Samuel Morse, the founder of the telegraph. Now, Jedediah Morse had given a very famous sermon, his Thanksgiving sermon, the year before. This is February of 1799. And his sermon on Thanksgiving Day was all about the Illuminati and its pernicious effect and the fact that it existed here in our country. And Washington's letter is simply to thank him, especially for the appendix, which was the sermon, the text of the sermon that he had given. So it existed, and there were people in our country who knew about this conspiracy against civilization. Well, from the Illuminati in 1776, we go to Italy's Carbonari movement in 1810. It's either a man named Giuseppe Mazzini, a young firebrand and a very brilliant man, a very brilliant organizer as well. His goal was also to work for him. This was the Illuminati program taken over by somebody else and continued. Mazzini went to England in 1847. He teamed up with Karl Marx. We go to Karl Marx, and we see the Communist Manifesto. I would suppose that some of you have seen it, maybe some of you have read it. And what you see is a repetition of the Illuminati program with some added steps to be taken. Abolish private property. Start the income tax. Start a national bank. Didn't we get both of those in 1913? You wanted all children in government schools. Wanted to replace home education. He specifically attacked home education. He attacked marriage and the family. He wanted to abolish countries and nationality, destroy eternal truths and religion, and he favored democracy. He said the first step in the revolution is to win the battle of democracy, and of course our country is a republic, and the difference between a republic and a democracy is essential to understand what this country is all about. The rule of law, for the rule of man. Very simple definition. And of course, what did Karl Marx want? World government. So we see this continuity of people advocating world government. Now, we can talk about others. In the meantime, I'm going to jump ahead now. We go to the Wilson administration. The two men pictured there are Wilson on the left and his alter ego, the man who was really his mentor, that's Edward Mandel House. House was a Texan. He had been a political wheeler dealer in Texas, and he set his sights on the entire country. And he moved up to the New York City area, and he seized a friendship with Woodrow Wilson. He wrote this book, Fourth Through Administrator, in 1912. 1912, of course, was the year that Wilson won the presidency. He entered the White House in 1913. But one of the interesting features of this book is that the dedicatory quote was by Italy's Giuseppe Martini. And there's a continuity there. Martini was the man that we just talked about, the head of the Carbonari in Italy. In the book, House said he was working for socialism as dreamed of by Karl Marx. That's a direct quote right out of the book. He wanted an income tax, as did Marx. He wanted the National Bank, the Federal Reserve. He wanted the Social Security system. He wanted to restructure the U.S. Constitution. He wanted an imperial presidency. And he wanted world government. He was as much a colonel as Colonel Landers of the chicken. It was an honorary title. He never served in the military. He went by the name of Colonel House. Now you can see there, this is the same program as before, and it ends up with world government. The income tax we got in 1913. The National Bank, the Federal Reserve, we got in 1913. We also got the direct election of senators, where the senators up until 1913 were appointed by the state legislatures for the purpose of guarding states' rights against the federal government. And that was a very significant move back then as well. So, we move on. Next comes the Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Roosevelt was given a copy of Philip Drew Administrator, the book by Edward Mandel House, by his own mother in 1920. In 1932, he gained the nomination of the Democrat Party for presidency. And the first person he visited after the winning the nomination, he went up to Massachusetts to Edward Mandel House's summer home to visit Edward Mandel House. In other words, it was all in the bag right from the beginning. He began to turn over the State Department to the Council on Foreign Relations in the late 1930s. And he accomplished what Wilson failed to accomplish. He built the Socialistic New Deal, Social Security system, and he steered the United States into the world government organization, the United Nations. And you might gather from this point that the John Birch Society is very much equivalent to the United Nations. Yes. Here we go. If you've ever seen a bumper sticker saying, get us out of the United Nations, we know it came from the John Birch Society. So, we mentioned here that he began to turn over the State Department to the Council on Foreign Relations. Okay? So here we have continuity through six generations. We had Weishaupt, and then Mazzini, and then Karl Marx, and then House and Wilson. And don't forget that House's book had the dedicatory quote in the book from Giuseppe Mazzini. Very significant. And then Franklin Roosevelt. And the goal was achieved. The United States entered the United Nations in 1945. The vote in the U.S. Senate was 89-2. The attitude had been spread that we've already had World War I, now we have World War II, we got to do something different. We got to have some other way of stopping there being another world war. And the people were sold on that, even good Americans, solidly good Americans. And then Robert Taft of Ohio voted to enter the United Nations. He later came out and said, the UN is a trap, let's go it alone, let's get out of this. But it was too late. So the goal was achieved. Now Roosevelt died in April of 45, and we didn't enter the UN until the vote in the Senate in the summer of 1945. But Roosevelt wanted that, and wanted it very much. Council on Foreign Relations was formed by Edward Mandel House. Formed by Edward Mandel House at the end of World War I, when the move was on to have the United States join the League of Nations. The U.S. Senate said no. And when they said no, then Hans got a cable. He was over in France working on the Versailles Treaty. And he and his British counterparts decided to form organizations to steer their nations into the world government. The British formed the Royal Institute for International Affairs. The U.S. branch of that is the Council on Foreign Relations. The honorary chairman for many, many years is David Rockefeller. Current chairman, Peter G. Peterson, a former Secretary of Commerce and an investment banker in New York City. The purpose was to function as an American branch of a secret society working for a world control. In the book, their secret society is taken from a book called Tragedy and Hope by Georgetown professor Carol Quigley, who wrote a 1,350-page book, The History of the World in Our Time. And he talked about and praised the idea of a world government and secret society bringing it about. Carol Quigley, Tragedy and Hope. The goal of the Council on Foreign Relations, announced very quickly in their Foreign Affairs magazine, the real problem today is that of the absence of world government. 4,282 members, not very many in a nation of 300 million people. But there are 464 government officials, 777 educators, these are the presidents of colleges and so forth. Business leaders, journalists, correspondents, and editors. You can look into the masthead of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and a lot of other Los Angeles Times, you'll find Council on Foreign Relations. You can go to Time, Newsweek, U.S. Civil War Report, and National Review. We conduct these magazines. Same thing. So the Council on Foreign Relations is the establishment. And when I talked about in my book that William Buckley is the Pied Piper for the establishment, this is what I'm talking about. He joined the Council on Foreign Relations in 1974 and publicly said he had joined and he was very disappointed because he had hoped to be a member as much as 10 years before. He said that in his own magazine. A major party presidential candidates beginning in 1952. All of the names that are circled were members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And you were told in 1952 you had a choice between the Democrat Stevenson and the Republican Eisenhower. But they were both CFR members. Same thing in 56. Same thing in 60, Kennedy versus Nixon. 64, Johnson versus Goldwater. Johnson chose Stephen Humphrey, a member of the Council, as his vice president. Filled his administration with Goldwater was surrounded by them, and it was those people who destroyed Goldwater's candidacy, much more so than the Democrat. 68, Humphrey versus Nixon. 72, McGovern versus Nixon. 76, Carter versus Ford. 1980, Carter versus Reagan. Reagan was not a member. He chose for his running mate, George H. W. Bush, a member of the board of directors of the Council on Foreign Relations. And he felt his administration. Mondale versus Reagan, Dukakis versus Bush 1, Clinton versus Bush 1, Clinton versus Dole. A lot of people don't even remember that Robert Dole was a candidate in 1996. He had such a poor campaign, I remember saying that if he'd run on the polls, he still would have lost. Al Gore versus Bush 2, neither of them remember. Both of them surrounded, but publicly come out and say, here's my advisory group, 17 out of 18 names, members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and so forth.
Excuse me, Bush, that means Bush
2 could be an
enemy. I'm sure they have to
say it. That could be.
I heard Reagan was...
I don't know that he did. I don't know. I don't know that. I know that the Indian Dole, I don't know if Reagan ever went there.
He did.
I know Kissinger was a frequent participant.
Now, what is the current Council on Foreign Relations attitude? This is the man who's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. For 350 years, sovereignty. And then he described what sovereignty is, the notion that states are the central actors on the world stage and that governments are essentially free to do what they want within their own territory, but not within the territory of other states. So sovereignty has provided the organizing principle of international relations. The time has come to rethink this. Are they opposed to national sovereignty? Are they in favor of world government? You read their publications, you'll see it. It's there. Imperialism, okay. You want to call it that? How do you get people to go to world government? Well, you threaten. You have inducements for them to go into world government. War, of course. A lot of people would say, you're going to have war, we're going to have a world government and avoid war. And some would say communism was a reason for us to go into world government. Well, I didn't say. True, completely fake. Nuclear bombs, nuclear weaponry was scaring people and saying we need world government. Global warming is being used to have people want world government, right? And the global warming thesis is more under attack all the time. It was just a meeting just last weekend in New York City, a week and a half ago. Scientists from all around the world gathered to put down the notion of global government being caused by human beings. And the latest threat and inducement to world government is free trade. And after it was being considered in 1993, Henry Kissinger, a member of the board of directors of the Council on Foreign Relations, came out and said, it, NAFTA, will represent the most creative step for the New World Order taken by any group of countries since the end of the Cold War, and the first step toward the even larger version of a free trade zone for the entire Western Hemisphere. They knew already what was happening in Europe, and they wanted it to happen here, the entire Western Hemisphere. So he's very much in favor of NAFTA. David Rockefeller, who doesn't write op-ed pieces very often, wrote one in 1993 in the Wall Street Journal. Grasping the moment means, first of all, we need the support of the American people, the administration, and Congress for NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement. Everything is in place after 500 years to build a true new world in the Western Hemisphere. And he put the quotes around the new world. So, here we have the chairman of the board of the Council on Foreign Relations and one of its most proud members, Mr. Kissinger, claiming that NAFTA is absolutely essential. So NAFTA was voted on in the Congress. The House approved it 234-200 in November of 93. The Senate approval 61-38 two days later in 97. President Clinton happily signed it, and NAFTA became part of our supposed legal system. It was just a little while ago that the Economic Policy Institute said that NAFTA had cost 879,000 U.S. jobs in the first 10 years, and that figure has been added to by others who now say that the number of jobs lost is about 3 million. Factories have relocated to Mexico, and some of those factories have now been transported to China. Borders have become more porous. Judicial panels from NAFTA overruled U.S. court decisions. Chapter 11 of NAFTA has already, on several occasions, overruled U.S. court decisions at state and federal level, and it paves the way for the North American Union. Now, you may have heard that the North American Union is a conspiracy theory. That's the way they put things out today. It's a conspiracy theory. I claim it's a conspiracy fact. In 2005, they formed the Security and Prosperity Partnership between among the United States, Canada, and Mexico. It was formed by President Bush, Vicente Fox of Mexico, and Prime Minister Paul Martin of Canada. It was launched in Texas at Waco, Texas, Baylor University. And it was followed in May of 2005 by a Council on Foreign Relations publication called Building a North American Community. If you look down at the bottom of this slide, you'll see an asterisk there. Mm-hmm. And in the forward to that book, CFR President Richard Haass, we've already talked about him, he calls for the establishment by 2010 of a North American Economic and Security Community. Ladies and gentlemen,
2010 is only 2 years away. And I'm not making this up. This is their own publications, their own attitudes. The Security and Prosperity Partnership now has 20 working groups at the Department of Congress, putting out rules and regulations, and nobody in Congress is seeing any of this. They are deriving their authorization from the NAFTA agreement to proceed to merge our three nations. The second SPP meeting was held in March 2006. It was Bush and Fox and a new Canadian named Harper. And now we have another Mexican named Calderon. The SPP is a major step toward the North American Union, and the eventual goal is world government. They met again in 2007 at the Montebello Resort in Quebec Province, Canada, and I went to the meeting. I couldn't get in. I got tear gas. Reminded me of my years in the Marine Corps. We had a little training to tear gas. But they continue. They're going to meet again now in New Orleans in April, the Security and Prosperity Partners. This is all preparatory to steering our three nations together. They formed the North American Competitiveness Council. These are the corporate giants, most of whom are led by members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Campbell Soup and Chevron, Ford, FedEx, General Electric, General Motors, Casey's Heavy Railroad, Lockheed Martin, Merck, Steel, We Have Life, Procter & Gamble, UPS, Walmart, World Food. The people who run these organizations are very interested in the bottom line, and the bottom line is better for them if there's no competition. And that's what they mean to do, have no competition. Here's a book published by a man named Robert Pastor, a professor left from right here in Washington, D.C., who just recently lost his job, by the way. He wrote this book. Toward a North American community. You see Fox on the left and Bush on the right. That's Robert Pastor in the middle. When the Council on Foreign Relations came out, building a North American community with their own publication, and you see that the people involved in it include Robert Pastor as one of the vice chairmen. The Canadian head is John Glaner, the Mexican is Pedro Acevedo. U.S. leader is doing well from the governor of Massachusetts. They need business.
John?
Yes,
And on the page that you can show there, you can have that book for you. Okay, if you want a hard copy of it, it's $60. If you notice over on the left-hand side there, on the downloadable portion, you can get it for free, so
download the whole book and read it for yourself.
Absolutely. You can keep on what I'm saying. If people don't believe what you're saying, or some people don't say, if you read what the CFR and what the FTP.gov site says, it confirms everything you're saying and then some.
That's right. That's right. All right, let's jump ahead. We see that in September of 2006, there was a meeting held called the North American Forum. It was held at a very plush resort in Banff in Alberta, Canada. September 12th through 13th. Secret meeting. And you're going to say to yourself, well, how do you know that? somebody come out and blew the whistle. Right?
We're very grateful for that.
We'll get to that. But this is what they intend. This is the sessions, 1 through 6. The American chairman of this was George Shultz. George Shultz, former Secretary of State, very big, prominent member of the Board of Directors of the Council on Foreign Relations, and so on. So they had opening comments and a vision for North America and an energy strategy and security cooperation and demographic and social dimensions of North American integration. Now, when you go home tonight, grab your dictionary, look up the word integration. What will you find? You will find that it means make as one. Make as one. I've looked at several different dictionaries, and they all come out the same. And then border infrastructure. Turn down, really. The meeting was held September 12th to 14th. Canadians, U.S., Mexicans. George Shultz was there. Donald Rumsfeld was invited. He didn't show up. and somebody else went in his place. He was too busy running the war in Iraq. Robert Festo was there. Carla Hills was the U.S. trade representative who was responsible for writing the NAFTA agreement back in the Carter and the Clinton administration. Mary Anastasio Grady is the Latin American columnist for the Wall Street Journal. I had some people write to Mary Anastasia O'Grady and say, how come you didn't tell us about the meeting in Banff in your column? She didn't answer. And a man named Thomas Shannon, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, and he came out of the meeting and he spoke in Ottawa and he said that the North American Forum is a parallel structure to the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. So, I'm not making it up. There it is. Now, the man who blew the whistle was a Canadian named Mel Hurdick. Mel Hurdick is a fairly well-known political author in Canada. He was invited to the meeting. He came out, he gave an interview to the Canadian Broadcasting Company. He said, we're talking about such an important thing. We're talking about the integration of Canada and Mexico into the United States. For them to hold this meeting in secret, to make every effort to avoid anybody learning about it right away, you've got to be secretly concerned. So thank you, Mal Verde, for blowing the whistle. Now, what I just read, it was a CBC broadcast. Yeah, CBC interview. He's made many statements about it. This is probably the most sweeping and the most tight or concerning place. Now, this is a map of what is called the NAFTA Superhighway. It's called the Trans-Texas Highway. It's called a whole bunch of other things. And as you can see, it starts in southern Mexico, port city of Lázaro Cárdenas. There's another port city in Guadalajara and then Manzanilla. And this is for building ports in these cities to be able to take all the cargo that comes from the Far East and have it come into Mexico where it will be unloaded and put on trucks and brought into the United States through a new highway system that is being built. But they deny it's being built. And yet, I've got some pictures of people taken in Texas where they're showing here's some of the structure is being built. Okay? And then you can see it goes up through the United States, it goes all the way to Canada, it goes into the Maritime Provinces, it goes all the way to Fairbanks, it goes up the West Coast, and so on. It goes through Kansas City, and Kansas City is supposed to be the first place where anything coming in from Mexico will have to go through any kind of an inspection procedure. And the inspection procedure in Kansas City will be manned by Mexicans. It's already been decided.
What about before the East Coast and the West?
No, it's going parallel. As in Texas, it's parallel at I-35.
Okay.
Right? Now, it's not just what we showed there. Here's another map where you see subsidiary roads are being built or planned to be built. Now, this map was put out by NASCO, N-A-S-C-O, the North American Super Carrier Coalition Incorporated. Am I making it up? The people in Oklahoma, led by members of the Bush Society, Oklahoma has passed a piece of legislation that if the government's run from Texas, it's stopping at the Oklahoma border. They've already said that.
And Chris said,
oh, I know they're saying it's not happening. They're saying it's a conspiracy theory. Here we got an article that was published in the Washington Times in March of 1999. And this article talks about Bush's brain trust. It talks about a meeting that was held at the home of George Shultz in Palo Alto, California. In April of 1998, that's 2.5 years before the election of 2000, which did end for several more weeks.
Started in the early 90s.
All right. What I'm pointing to, though, is the brain trust that was formed to train George Bush to be the President of the United States. George Shultz, and who's at the meeting?
Richard Cheney.
Richard Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, George Shultz, Paul Wolfowitz, and others.
Right.
Now, the man who wrote this article throws a great idea. He never would have published it. So they kept it up for 2 years, and he's talking about the fact that it's been kept up with conference calls and seminars and meetings in Austin, Texas, and elsewhere, when they're training Mr. Bush to be the president, right? So he gets the nomination in the summer of 2000, and he turns to one of the members of his brain trust, Richard Cheney, and he says, I want you to search the country and find me a vice president. He searched the country with your apartment. He came up with Cheney. Alright, so there we go. Alright, now what else? This is a description of this meeting. It was held in April 98. Schultz, Cheney, Rice, Wolfowitz, seminars in Austin, Texas, telephone conference calls, faction emails, wins the nomination, friends to Cheney, find a running mate, and then appoints 500 members of the Council on Foreign Relations to his administration. Now, here's an interesting picture. This is a picture that was taken in the White House in January of 2006. George Bush had sent out a message to all former state and defense secretaries to come to the White House and to help me to know what to do about Iraq. So every one of them there is a former Secretary of State or Defense. And the only person in the photo who was not a member of the Council on Foreign Relations is Bush. Every single one. Every single one. But it's a conspiracy theory. Okay.
And none of those are true, right? Yeah. None of those are true, right?
Okay, just checking. Vicente Fox said, eventually our long-range objective is to establish an ensemble of connections and institutions similar to those created by the European Union. Robert Pastor said, NASA has the benefit of learning from EU mistakes as well as successes. So we're going to take a look at the European Union. And you see that it started off as a coal and steel community with six nations in 1952. And then it became the European Economic Community, the common market, and the people were told that this was simply a trade agreement. Then it became the European Community. And then in 86, they changed the name to the European Union. In 1993, they added more nations, now 12. They introduced the euro. In 2006, they added more than about 27 nations. Václav Klaus is the president of the Czech Republic. He is still the president. He said, this is crossing the Rubicon, after which there will be no more sovereign states in Europe, only one will remain. British authors Christopher Booker and Richard Dawes have published a book called The Great Deception, The Secret History of the European Union. They label the European Union as the most spectacular coup d'etat in history. It is. Mike Mattress is a member of the leadership of the United Kingdom Independence Party. He's fighting against it. The EU was sold to the British people as a trading agreement, has turned into a political union which is changing our basic laws and provisions. Then we see that just about a year ago, a man named Roman Herzog, who was the president of Germany for 5 years, he said recently, 84% of the legal acts in Germany stem from EU headquarters in Brussels. The question has to be raised of whether Germany can still unreservedly be called a parliament of the moment. These nations have given up their sovereignty. There are many people in Europe who now begin to understand it. The British people were promised a referendum on this new treaty that they've come up with, and the British leader, Gordon Brown, successor of Tony Blair, has just said, no, we're not going to have one. And they went to the British Parliament of the British Parliament and said, no, we're not going to have a referendum. They were afraid to have a referendum. What happened is that they had a constitution. And the constitution was put out in 2004, and it went through various countries, and some of the countries had referenda, and the French and the Dutch voters turned the thumbs down, and that killed the constitution. The European Union, but so they went to Lisbon in 2007 and they came up with a treaty. And they are willing to say behind the scenes, and I have several quotes, I don't have them here in the program, several quotes as saying the treaty is the same as the Constitution, but it's in much more cluttered language. And the people will understand.
But
the only nation that is guaranteed to have a referendum on this is Ireland. Ireland will have a referendum in June. And if Ireland turns one down, it has to be unanimous, then that will kill the treaty. And so the activity in Ireland is immense, even then. I'm in touch with some people from Ireland, and I get some very interesting information back and forth from them. So the European Union is what the goal is for our country. We know that because they've said it. Robert Pastor said it. Vicente Fox said it for the entire Western Hemisphere. The European Union's constitution that came out in 2004, it actually stated, and of course this doesn't appear in the new treaty. The constitution and law adopted by the Union's institutions exercising competencies conferred upon it shall have primacy over the law of member states. Is that in the treaty? Yes. As explicitly, no. But it's in the treaty. And one of my confidants is a retired professor from Trinity University in Dublin, and he has sent me an analysis of the treaty, and it's just devastating to read. Now, throughout that constitution, you see EU subservience to the UN. Right? You see strict observance to the UN Charter, in accordance with the Charter. I've read this. Right? Respect for the Charter, conformity to the Charter, without prejudice to the Charter, establishing all appropriate forms of cooperation with the Charter. Is this whole thing leading toward the United Nations and a world government? Absolutely. All right, now, think of this. You got 192 nations in the UN. If you want to have a world government, are you going to subvert 192 nations one at a time? Or are you going to get them into groups and subvert the groups? That's where we are. That's what the UN is, that's what the EU is all about, and that's what is intended by the NAFTA agreement and then the Security and Prosperity Partnership, the North American Union, which will then be expanded to include all of the Western Hemisphere. This is an extremely interesting quote, poster here. It was put out by the Council of Europe, which is a branch of the European Union. It was put out 20-some-odd years ago, before it was the European Union. And you see them here, they want to rebuild the Tower of Babel. The significance of that, if you know any of Genesis, is that nationhood began at the Tower of Babel. Confusion of the tongues, the people who grew up with each other spoke and formed nations. And for them to put out a poster where they're rebuilding the Tower of Babel is huge. They don't put this poster out anymore. But this is 20 years old. You can see the workmen down there, and you can see the crane and so forth. And you see on the left there is a painting of a Flemish artist named Bruegel. What he had put out in the 16th century was copied by them when they put their poster out. I don't know that Bruegel was a person. He was just putting out an artist's depiction of what he thought would be the Tower of Babel. No? Oh, I've seen it.
It looks a lot like that.
It looks a lot like that, right? Here's what Ron Paul said. The ultimate goal is not simply a superhighway, but an integrated North American Union, complete with currency, the MLO, AMERO. A cross-national bureaucracy and virtually borderless travel with the Union. Like the European Union, a North American Union would represent another step for the abolition of national sovereignty altogether.
How do you make plans for
the European Union? Located on private sea. You know, it's in the background. Well, our money's become a locus without even an American.
Yeah, we are meeting more for 2 years.
It's a piece of legislation being introduced in Congress. Introduced by a congressman named Booth, G-O-O-D-E, in Virginia. He now has 15 or 20 co-sponsors. That's not enough. But the word is spreading.
there's a pamphlet that I wrote called Block the North American Union by Greg Westheimer. This is a magazine that we put out. This is our new American magazine. I happen to be the publisher. I write articles for almost 7 issues. This is called Merger in the Making. We went to a meeting at the State Department Monday, a meeting where we were talking about expanding NAFTA, expanding the SPP, and even now developing a what they call a TEC, Transatlantic Economic Commission, which is going to have us heavily into the European Union, even before they do it formally. And they gave some of the State Department people copies of the magazine. We're sorry that we haven't been here for you, but we should do it.
Can you explain to them how they can go on the site to get the EGM model?
Yes, you can go to jbs.org, or you go to newamerican.com, and you can download the entire magazine in PDF format. And David Rockefeller put out his own book in 2000 called Memoirs. Quoted, and he said, some even believe we're a part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and interests internationally, and are conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated Canadian political and economic structure. But that accusation he made doesn't have. Hi, David. Hope you're on the same. One world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty and I am proud of it, said David Rockefeller. Some of you may remember the name of Congressman named Ryan McDonald.
Yeah.
He was on KAL-007, the Soviet attacked the plane in midair, and you never saw him or any of the other people on the plane. Before he was done in, he was at the time the head of the John Birch Society. And a Democrat, I'm good. Democrat, Republican, able managed maybe, not much else. The drive of the Rockefellers and their allies is to create a one-world government combining super-capitalism and communism under the same tent, all under their control. Do I mean conspiracy? Yes, I do. I am convinced there is such a plot in international scope. Generations in planning and incredibly evil things. One of the victims of KAL-007, September 1st, 1983. I knew that in the coming day. So what are we going to do? Well, there's the answer. It's Congress. Notice I did not put up the letters. The answer is Congress. A constitution that is so much honored, but then put in the bottom drawer. Article 1, Section 7, all bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, ladies and gentlemen, and that's where the power is. The House. If the House will not institute a bill to raise revenue for, you name it, that's it. There's nothing the Senate, the President, the Supreme Court, or the New York Times can do about it.
And that's where it should be stopped.
That's where a lot of things should be done. Now, there's enough in Congress right now to do what I think. You know, imagine a country as heavily indebted as we are, giving away foreign aid. Sister Bush just came back from a six-nation trip in Africa, and every country promised more aid. The United States has just sent $1.4 billion to Mexico for them to build a fence on their southern border to protect against illegal immigration from Guatemala.
I did.
Isn't that wonderful? His age Conrad's 40 also introduced by Mr. Cudi and his now 45 co-sponsors. The United States should not engage in the construction of an NAFTA superhighway or enter into a North American Union with Mexico. If you have any influence with a congressman, tell him to get on board. H. Conrad's 40. So what about the John Birch Society? Started in 1958. We're going to have our 50th anniversary in the fall. Education is the strategy, weapon for truth, and revelation of the field study. We don't need studies in all of us. Promoting the aims and goals of the society, reaching out to new people. We say concerted action. Not everybody left 75 different directions. Let's work together on the public defense. And we can indeed break the back of the conspiracy.
We had the New American Magazine. We had a speakers group. We had literature distribution. Book publishing. Create awareness about the unique American system. Experience to spread freedom. The importance of morality and truthfulness and the need for Americans to go. At the end of that founding meeting in 1958, when he spent 11 men for 2 full days, and I'm not going to do that, he said, come join us in our proud companionship in the Olympic and the Olympics. And that's where we are today. So there you have a little bit of a view of some of the thoughts of the John Birch Society. I'm sure I didn't answer all the questions, but I'll be happy to entertain any questions. Let me also again say that I want everybody, before you go home, take a copy of this. It's a 30-minute program written for Bruce by himself, as the Irishman said. And it's about what our country was supposed to be and how we're departing from it. And there are about 30,000 copies of that already being circulated throughout the country. Question?
I'd like to hear from you what the CFR people and preliminary people are saying to
Well, many of them, the benefit is in the making. You aspire to become a member of this, you will see your name, you will see yourself progressing in the business world or in government or in some other place. You will be honored in the journalistic realm. You will have all kinds of perks and so forth. I would say of the members of the Council on Foreign Relations, the 4,000 plus of them, a few of the 10% of them are conspirators, and most of them are go along to get along, and they're willing to do anything at all for self-promotion. That's very, very hard. Yes. So keep in mind, too, a very interesting summation of that threat, and that is that monopolies don't exist without the government. You have a system of freedom, there will always be competition. And when a company gets big, another small little competitor will have less overhead, less problems that he has to deal with, and so forth. And he'll be able to compete and grow. And that's the story of America. Unless you have governments to guard. Right. Unless you have regulatory agencies that favor some and don't favor others. All kinds of everything. Funds to finance the Iraq war coming from
China. Well,
the
borrower from
China.
$60,000
Well, it's at least that. And we have the government now is going to send everybody a check. You're going to get a rebate. Where are they going to get the money? They're either going to print it or borrow it from China. Right. And this is going to solve the recession? No. There are thousands and thousands of jobs. America was a great producer. Wealth is productivity. Wealth is not a stack of paper. Wealth is productivity. A wealthy nation is one that takes the raw materials of the earth and fashions them into goods. That's what America was. We're the greatest producers. And we have lost our manufacturing base. Continues to flood out of our country. Jobs are being lost. Companies are closing down. And the government is behind. That's right. Agribusiness. The Cargill. I saw recently, too, that the government in the state of Sonora in Mexico, which is south of Arizona, this was in Texas this week, has protested in the United States that they don't want those Mexicans coming back. Arizona has passed fairly strict legislation. If you hire or if you house an illegal immigrant, you're breaking the law in Arizona. But it's working. We're worried about it just like everybody else, and what we're trying to do is to get the government to stop throwing money away. We've been at that for a long time. The John Birch Society has opposed foreign aid from day one. Have we succeeded? No, we haven't. Why? We don't have enough people. We don't have enough members in the society. We have the program. We have the history. We know all about what's happening. We know who's doing it. Everything else. What we need is more Americans to get the boat and pull on the water. Stop being a passenger. So, I'm not here to recruit, but if that's what you're thinking of, you'd certainly be right. But do yourself a favor, and remember, JBS.org. Every day we put up news feeds, we put up commentaries on what's going on in the world. That's it.
in China, they have a 1-party system. The issue in the United States, we're not quite so honest about that kind of thing.
We have two branches of the one establishment.
Right. Yeah. So if what you're saying about the so-called two-party system here in the United States is correct, which I do agree with you on that, what can we do to establish
the House of Representatives is where we take back the power, and the House of Representatives is not nearly as controlled as the top, the presidency, and then the Senate, and so forth. So that's the answer. We take our country back to the House of Representatives, and I can't stress that too much. Well, we agree with them economically. We disagree with them a little bit on some of the social concerns. We are opposed to abortion. We believe it's murder. We are opposed to flooding the country with drugs and they say we're not letting go. So we're not libertarians, but we have friends in many of the subject matters. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think,
yeah, thank you very much.
And who else? We had John McManus. And we're done for this week's program. Keep reading total411.info. Keep going to revereradio.org. And peace.